Hello, and welcome to EPR with your favorite environmental nerds, Nick and Laura. On today's episode, we're going to start with our shoutouts.
Nick and I discuss how improv and stand-up comedy relate to public speaking.
We are then joined by Lauren Stanek to talk about sustainability, food forests, and running your own business. Nick was super excited about getting her name right before we started talking to her, and then immediately was just like,
right away. Oh, it hurts.
So stay tuned for that. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review before you leave us today. Hit that music.
Okay, our shout outs for today. I want to give a huge thanks to Allie McGuire for helping us manage our conferences, both last year when we had to shift from having it in Florida to virtual, which is really challenging. And she helped support us all the way through that. And she's helping us this year as well. So thank you, Allie, so much for your time and effort. Allie. It's super great. We couldn't do it without you. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I also want to give a shout out to Carrie Kelly, longtime TBA member. That's not her name. Her name's not Carrie Kelly Longtime, is it?
No, she's a longtime member of TBAP and a longtime friend of mine.
Right. So yeah, I want to give a shout out to Carrie Kelly, who is a longtime member of TBAEP, and she's a senior ecologist, vice president at Flatwoods Consulting Group. She just got promoted to being a vice president, which is super great. So congrats to Carrie. That's awesome.
Yay.
Like I say, we love doing these little shout outs for you guys. So please be sure to give us your promotions, you know, new jobs or professional awards that you have. So go to the EPR website, environmentalprofessionalsradio.com, and let us know. Again, I know we've said it a few times already, but please, please don't forget to go register for the NAEP conference on May 17th through the 20th. It's a really, really good time. It's going to be really, there's going to be a lot of really good information coming out about it. So please, please do go check out naep.org and register today.
Stop begging, Nick.
You know what? No, I will not stop begging. I will never do that. Guys, go. Go. It's going
to
be fun.
Nick is on his knees. Please come to the conference. There are opportunities for everyone who's just starting their career to seasoned fellows and whatnot. So something there for everybody.
There really are. So yeah, please do check it out. It should be really fun this year. So yeah, if you could, and like you said, Laura, it's virtual, so no excuses. So if you would like to sponsor a future episode, head over to environmentalprofessionalsradio.com and check out our sponsor form for details. So yeah, I think we talked to Lauren about improv and how that kind of applies to our profession. And I know it seems strange, but there are a lot of parallels that we can use from that. Yeah, fun fact, you've alluded to on the show that I am a comedian, and I would say I'm a hobbyist that enjoys doing stand-up comedy. I think the people here would tell me, Nick, calm down. Don't get too excited. But it is something really fun for me. And I really do. It's how I fill my bucket up, is going on stage and getting, you know, ridiculed and then walking off. I don't know why, but that's that's one of those things I love to do.
Masochism at its best. Right?
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's something about it. It's a challenge, and it's a lot of fun to do. And it's a lot of, you know, planning and interesting things that go into it. But it really does apply. Like, the reason I even wanted to do it, besides the fact that I like making people laugh, right? That's number one. But like, I just wanted to find a way to practice public speaking. And I couldn't think of anything harder than that. And you can do it on a consistent basis. You can do it in different ways and in front of very different audiences. And all of that matters. And so it kind of allows you to, it gives you flexibility. You have to learn how to roll with punches. And, you know, sometimes I'll challenge myself to come up with a way to introduce myself in a new and different way so that I can kind of use that as a tool for learning for when I have to give professional presentations. And it's honestly helped me be just a little bit more comfortable, right? If you can go on stage and tell a joke and have no one laugh at you and then get back on stage, you can do anything. So, you know, that's one of those things that it's a different way of using a hobby to kind of help support what you do it as a career. But yeah, it's pretty powerful. I know you've had some experience with some of that, right?
Not really. No? I took an improv class once. I remember Ruth Eckert Hall in Florida has comedy and acting classes, and they had an improv thing. And I think I went or signed up. I think I went to one and never returned.
So yeah, definitely not. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of my friends were in drama. I did have one friend who was a comedian. We went to watch him do the stand-up. So I can visualize you there at the open mic night, just hoping that somebody will laugh. And oh man, that's, I don't know if anyone listening has not ever been that or done that. It is brutal. to what? It's like watching a train wreck in slow motion.
Yeah, but before we get too far down, I've also made lots of people laugh, to be fair.
Yeah, I'm not saying my friend himself, but just the lineup of people. There are going to be like a few people who get laughs, and there's those ones who've been coming for a while. So like people expect them to be funny. So they're going to, you know, because there's that too. Like, maybe that guy's not funny, but we know him. So.
Right. I know.
But there's always watching the ones who are just like suffering is so...
It's
hard to feel for them.
Yeah. And an open mic is a very different experience than like a show. Right. And so what I would tell people is,
I mean, what's different?
Well, it's because what you're trying to do there is learn what works, right? You're trying out a joke and you're trying to find the best way to say a joke because the words very much matter. And sometimes even just changing a little bit of your delivery can make a joke go from good to great. And, you know, you don't know that. Honestly, you have an idea, but you don't really know that until you get up there. And sometimes you get surprised by stuff. You're like, wow, that was much funnier than I thought it would be. Or, wow, I've got some work to dig out of the hole I just dug myself into. And, you know, I think the more you do it, so an open mic is just not going to be a place that if you want to see good comedy, it doesn't mean you can't laugh there and you won't find really funny things, but that's where everybody practices, you know, and that's practice for public speaking, for the show. And so the show is where if they're not laughing in a show, which does happen, then somebody's, you know, messed up. The comic's messed up. That's usually not the audience's fault. It's almost never the audience's fault. It's almost always the comic. But it's a test of confidence more than anything else. You know, you have to be confident. You have to deliver your joke the way you would, like you were doing it in front of a mirror. And that's the thing that, you know, I really wanted to work on for me, because it's really important to say things confidently. Say what you mean, you know, and don't back down when you're a little nervous. And so, yeah, it's a really good challenge. But yeah.
As far as improv goes, I mean, like, whose line is it anyway? It's just brilliant. And that's probably most exposure I've ever had to watching improv actually happen. And maybe also watching Bill Hader and Barry.
Yeah, for sure.
But see, I'm more of a but person than a yes and.
Right. Yeah.
So how does improv, or how could somebody who's trying to learn in a practical sense, if I'm trying to improve my public speaking, how could I use improv to do that?
Well, it's like one of the basic tenets of improv. And full disclosure, I have not taken an improv class. It's just something that I've just done a ton of because my friends are mean. But yes and is basically whenever somebody gives you a thing, like, you know, I'm walking to the grocery store. You don't say no or but or you say, yeah. And these dumbbells we're carrying really is kind of foolish, you know? And so these should be grocery bags instead or whatever it is, you know, you just want to keep the conversation going.
The other person.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're basically continuing a conversation instead of shutting it down. And I think a lot of the time when we're hearing things or we're surprised by stuff in general, we have a tendency to kind of try to move away from it as quickly as possible. But then you're not listening and you're not actually hearing what the other person is saying. So you really have to pay attention to, you know, who you're talking to, what they're talking about, and the people in the room. You know, you have to pay attention to the quote unquote audience so that you understand how best to address the situation, you know? And sometimes you'll say some really great stuff. You'll get some really good detail out of there, but it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a challenge too. So being prepared to prepare, you guess basically it's being prepared for the unpredictable. And so you can never be totally prepared, but if you at least have some tips and tools on how to do that, it's going to serve you well in just about any meeting that you have to run.
You know, probably the closest thing that I have practiced to that is table topics in Toastmasters meetings.
Yeah.
We did actually have a guest who came to our meeting, who Toby Martini. He's actually an improv guy. And I think he makes a living doing improv stuff. And he was just awesome. The one thing I really remember is he would say when he was starting a meeting, he would let his breath out, suck it in, push out his chest. And it was like the Superman thing, like, all right, here we go.
Here we go.
And no apologies. This is how it is. And he was a very confident speaker. So how does, what else aside from maybe table topics at Toastmasters could someone do?
So yeah, I think that's a great suggestion, you know, because what you're looking for are safe spaces, right? You want to be able to do something and say something and make mistakes and it not be overwhelming and terrifying, right? And so I think those are probably the best examples. You know, you can do those two things. They're great ways for you to practice in front of people that you don't know. And sometimes that's actually easier to do than it is in front of people you do know, but it gives you that confidence when you're going back into a meeting. And I think, you know, even taking an improv class, I know one of my engineer friends did the same exact thing. He did, you know, he's like, I'm mortified, of stand-up. I don't want anything to do with it, but I took this course because I wanted to get better at just talking to people, right? And having conversations that go in different directions. And so even doing something like that is, again, those are very safe spaces most of the time. And you're not going to be knocked for not doing well. You know, they don't expect you to be an expert. And so they're supportive, kind, and, you know, that kind of thing goes a long way and is pretty easy to do. So that's my big one. Yeah.
Cool. Well, all right. Get out there and start practicing talking off the cuff. And let's turn this over and start talking to Lauren Stanek. Super excited to have her here. Let's get started.
Okay. We are here today with Lauren Stanek, who runs Rehabitat, a design and project management WBE certified business in Syracuse that combines her love of interior design, project management, and sustainability. Lauren, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, what drew you to sustainability and starting up this business?
So my sustainability journey actually began in my undergraduate career at RIT, which is the Rochester Institute of Technology. I was enrolled in interior design studies, and it was towards the beginning, actually, well, we were on trimester. So it was the beginning of my sophomore year that I was invited to participate in an independent study, which has the focus on sustainability in general in the built environment. And it was kind of a crash course in what sustainability was. That's the very beginning, at least at that point in time, it was the beginning of the US Green Building Council and their initiatives. And things were really starting to take foothold professionally, I would say, in the world of interior architecture and sustainability. So I got involved at that point in time. And one of the very first things that we did as part of this independent study was read a, I don't know, 3-page article from the New York Times, which I still cannot find. I've searched for it everywhere. I'm everywhere, online, everywhere, and I cannot find it. And it was the thing that made the light bulb turn on for me. Basically, it was all about the idea of Native Americans and the principles of the 7 generations. And it was in reading that it all just made sense. And I thought, oh my gosh, like I have to dedicate myself to this. And that's where it all started.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredible. And sustainability is one of those things that's easy to define and hard to implement. So what do you see as the biggest obstacles to implementing that across business and how you combat that?
Sure. So for me, I have never met an owner that was not interested in sustainability in general. Everyone conceptually really agrees with the ideas and the principles. There's never a doubt about that. What ends up happening is that as we start to discuss project budgets, that's where I tend to see the idea of it fall off. And it's not just because they haven't planned for it at the onset, especially as we're dealing with existing buildings. Things just cost more. There's found conditions. There's things that we just come across that are just total unknowns. And so that's when you start to see the sacrifice in some of the sustainability measures. I mean, you might have this really great idea to do a mechanical system that's, you know, super efficient. And unfortunately, it just costs more because it's so much of the construction cost, for example. So a lot of it tends to get mixed with the actual costs of things. Be damned payback.
Yeah. And do you see that changing? Is sustainability becoming more and more, I guess, profitable?
I'll say that I think that sustainability is becoming 100% more affordable. I think that there is a huge amount of products in the marketplace now that as we think of it, as it relates to not just interior design, but also the building systems that we start to implement. I think that there's enough competition in the marketplace now that it allows us to get really good quality products for a lower cost than what we were probably originally seeing. So yeah, I think that it's becoming more and more common. I think the other huge benefit is that as building codes have kind of inched along and gotten a little bit closer to some of the LEED standards and become more aggressive, the budgets definitely have to account for the cost of certain things in a way that maybe they didn't have to previously.
Yeah, that's great. And yeah, it's incredible. And one of the things I noticed just looking through your resume too, you've someone who started your own business and you've run it successfully for years. So do you have any advice for anyone else that's either starting out or really how to keep things going?
Sure. You just have to do it.
It's a good theme.
Yeah, you just have to do it. I had thought about starting a company for years, probably 10 or more years before I ever actually did. And I was always waiting for the right time, the right time, the right time. And I think that there's something to be said for that.
Right.
The reality was, is that my right time came from a really difficult situation, meaning it was going to be less difficult for me to be out on my own and figuring it out than the situation that I was in. So for me, that was the right time. And I think that just doing it, and then the next part of that is to say, but make sure that you have the appropriate contacts in place. So if you're ever going to go out on your own, like, you definitely want to have a good accountant. You definitely want to have a good lawyer. And, you know, make sure that you've got like some guardrails in place, right? Like if you were bowling, like you bowl with the bumpers, like you're gonna hurl yourself down this alleyway, but like, make sure that there's some parameters that help make sure that you're successful in that endeavor.
And so I'm guessing you wouldn't have it any other way now. Looking back, would you change anything about how you did it?
Absolutely not. I find what I do to be so inspiring. I love that I can help a huge variety of people. I love to meet new people on a regular basis. And I think one of the biggest, most satisfying things about running my business is that I find that throughout the course of a project, like, I end up having clients that are friends. Like, that's the biggest thing for me is that I get to walk away and I'm like, yeah, okay, like, that went pretty well. And, you know, I got a friend out of it. This is great.
That's awesome. Honestly, it should be the ultimate goal for everybody, right? Like, it's when you work with people you genuinely care about, you can't fake that.
Right.
And so that's great to hear. And so you also have a podcast yourself. Is that right?
I do. Yeah. It's relatively new. It's called Subject to Change. And we focus on this very evolving conversation approach to sustainability. So what we attempt to do is have guests on that are from all aspects of sustainability, whether it is, you know, health and wellness, whether it's the built environment. We actually just had a gentleman by the name of Kenyon Black on from Upward Bound, which is a federal program that has first generation. Basically, it's an application process to get involved in this kind of extracurricular group through the Syracuse City School District. Well, ours, the city of Syracuse. Federally, it's elsewhere, obviously.
Right.
And they basically, they're all going to be first generation college students in some capacity. So it's all kind of the training ground to make sure that they're prepared to go off and succeed in college. The program starts in eighth grade and obviously goes through the completion of their high school careers and ultimately college. And it was probably one of the most uplifting interviews that I have had ever. I mean, he's my new personal hero. He is so passionate about what he does. And the program is so amazing. I mean, he's got people, he's been doing it for 11 years and he still maintains relationships with students from 11 years ago. I think it's so cool.
Yeah, that's, wow, that's great.
And,
yeah. So Laura, okay, like, we're gonna have to get him on the podcast now and go listen.
Get him. He's so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Please go
New
listen
question
to the interview
for everyone. Who's your favorite guest so we can steal them?
Yeah, so we can take them. Well, it's funny. We've been joking off air all the time that we should ask everybody if they know who Bill Hader is and if you could get him on the podcast. So if you do know Bill, please, you know, give us, you know, give him a call. He's a, you know, that's who we want. That's our ultimate goal. Our
who prize. Is he?
He's an actor, SNL.
I will say that one of our other most interesting interviews was with a guy that does improv for a living. And it's so cool to see how improv actually like ticks back to sustainability.
Yeah.
Concept wise, it's kind of this idea of like rolling with the punches, you know, always going for the positive, like you take the positive thing and you project it forward. Like, it was really cool to see how it can all tie together. We got like three episodes out of him too.
Yeah.
If you want that guy, I can give you his name as well.
That's perfect.
Well, that would be overload because Nick is also a comedian. So just have a romping good time with that.
That's great. Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned that though. Like, there really are, I love when things like that line up, right? There's so much that, you know, you can take from different avenues and different, you know, artistic outlets and apply it to what you do, which is a sneaky, great transition to my next question for you. Like, you have, what is it? Food for us, right? And I definitely didn't have to look that up before we started the thing, but maybe you can explain what it is and what got you into it.
Sure. So when I first moved into the suburbs and had land, I did not want to follow the course of what most people would do as far as their landscape was concerned. Mm-hmm. I challenged myself to do two specific things. One is to have my property certified as a natural wildlife habitat, which was able to do. And the second was to have probably about 95% of all of my landscaping be edible. And so one of the ways that I went about doing this is I didn't want to have like standard gardens, things that constantly had to be like watered and kind of cared for. I wanted to have the sense of a very natural landscape. And so as I was going through and learning and reading more and more about the science and study of permaculture, I came across this even kind of more kind of organized but still wild looking approach, which is called a food forest. And so it's this whole hierarchy of different types of plantings that work together. So you start with something like a fruit or a nut tree as kind of the anchor point of it. And then you go to smaller fruit producing trees around it, followed by fruit or nut producing bushes. And then you get into things like annuals or perennials or a mixture of the two of different types of plantings around it. And so it creates this really kind of robust ecosystem where all of the vegetables and fruit and nuts and everything, they all work together. You're also supposed to like sneak some vines up in there so you can like grow grapes up the trees. It's pretty cool. It can get really dense and you can get a ton of food production on a really small lot of land. And because of natural shading aspects and everything, like you don't have excessive water that needs to be used as well. So it's super energy and water efficient.
Right. And it's, I don't want to say it takes care of itself, but it seems like the work isn't nearly as much as you would think.
Correct. Once you get it kind of established. I mean, everybody knows when you first plant things for, you know, about the first season. I mean, obviously you're watering and making sure that they take. But after that, it's very minimal hands-on. Like you just have to go out and basically harvest and that's it. Unlike gardens, for example, because the weeds actually become, the more you study, weeds are actually very local, many times often, if not edible, at least medicinal, you know, components of our ecosystem. So they're actually kind of encouraged in a lot of respects.
Yeah. I think the neatest thing about it is like the layers. Like there's just like, they could say there's a full on forest. When you say that, that's what it means. And that kind of blew me away. So that's really incredible that you found that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a lot of fun to put together. Yeah. That part was good too.
Oh gosh. So you got a favorite food that comes out of your forest. There's got to be something.
Oh, my puffball mushrooms.
Puffball mushrooms. Wow. And so what is a puffball mushroom?
Is that a puffball mushroom is literally like a mushroom that gets to be like the size of one of the little like kid soccer balls.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And they're awesome. So you can eat them. You can pop them into stir fry. Obviously I make a great mushroom miso soup with them. There's all kinds of things you can go on. If you just search like puffball mushroom recipes,
It's just,
you're not at a shortage.
And so now it's my most important question for you. So when the apocalypse happens, can we stay with you? Is that okay?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
It's on record. You heard it, Laura. She said it. So.
Well, I live here near her, so we're going to do some puffball appetizers, something soon. Next, Green Drinks, which Lauren and I met through, was it through Green Drinks or was it? I think it was because we were talking about starting NAEP New York Syracuse chapter. Mm-hmm. And then we connected because you run the Green Drinks. So, you know, you've been doing that a really long time.
I've lost track of how long I've been doing it. The pandemic has made it really hard. We've only done a couple of online sessions, I think, for me and my group, I'll say, I don't want to speak for the others. I think that it's so much more valuable to meet in person. So I'm waiting. I think people maybe didn't mind the break. And now I think people are getting really antsy to get back to it. Cause I get asked literally every single week about when do we start? And I'm like, when are we vaccinated? I don't know.
Yeah, I know. But that's always a hard part. Is just trying to balance that now, especially, but you're right. I don't know how you see your team. Like, obviously they're different and some of them are going to want to stay home. Some of them aren't. Do you have an idea how to balance that and manage when things do get back to normal, quote unquote?
I know that there's a lot of times when I'm personally more impactful by working from home.
Yeah, agreed.
Not coming in and having the distractions. So I think that I will always have a balance of that where I would want people, even if they are employees of mine, that they'll have that freedom to, you know, come in, check in at the office, but also work from home. I think that it just, I think people are happier having that balance.
Yeah, for sure. And I think if anything, that's what the pandemic has taught us, that is that we can be flexible. And, you know, just because things change doesn't mean we have to go back to the way things were either. So yeah, you also mentioned a story about a phone call that came through during your master's thesis. Is that right?
Yeah. So
tell us about that.
Sure. So this was a frightening, funny, but frightening moment in my opinion. I did my master's thesis, ages ago at this point. And I was looking at deconstruction, several aspects of it, basically looking at the environmental, social, and economic approaches towards deconstruction in areas that are impacted by sea level rise that would be unavoidable at some point, and what we were going to do with the existing building stock. And so as part of my research, obviously I had started to learn a lot about funding of large scale projects. And I should state that my particular focus was on the Empire State Building, which is not part of the flood zone or anything, but there's just a lot of documentation about that building in general. So I was able to kind of quantify certain things. That's why I chose that study. And as I was learning about the different types of funding sources and loans that go into these really large scale commercial properties, it became very clear that there's basically subsequent loans that kind of time out, right? Like, so there's one that then gets canceled by the next one that gets canceled by the next one, but there's, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 loans on a huge, massive commercial property at any given time. Right. And what they do is instead of paying off the loan over time, they just go get a loan that pays off the loan. So I called a bank and I said, okay, so I just want to make sure that I'm understanding this properly. And so I kind of outlined what it was that I surmised, and they said, yeah, that's about how it works. And I said, great. So I'm just curious, like, what do you care? Like, how is insurance and stuff covered on these types of properties? Are you aware of the 2030 challenge? And have you seen the maps and the types of flooding that's set to occur on some of our major cities? Right. And therefore the building stock that have, like, you know, 4 or 5 loans on them, some of which you could be funding. And he goes, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh no.
And I go, no, seriously. Like, and I walked him through the whole, I walked him through all of my research, where I was coming from, and the other end of the phone went silent. And he said, ma'am, do you mean to tell me that this is actually happening? And I said, yes, go on 2030architecture.org. Look at the flood maps. I said, this is, like, it's being researched right now. And he goes, oh my God, I've got to go talk to my boss about this. And, like, that was, like, the end of the conversation. So yeah, I feel like, you know, somehow I scared the crap out of someone at a major lending facility whose name shall remain nameless, but
of course,
it left me with very little hope that the others were doing much more about it. Yeah. So it's not really funny. It's actually quite disturbing.
But you can't do anything but laugh, because otherwise we'd be crying.
Right. Exactly. It's one of those situations.
Yeah. And so that's based on the flooding that happened with Hurricane Sandy. Is that right? Is that where that came from?
I think that it was actually Hurricane Katrina, if memory serves, that got me kind of started on the path of where my master's thesis went. Right. Hurricane Sandy actually came after the fact. And it was just more kind of food for thought. It actually made me think about going and starting another research project, though, that was associated in particular with what ends up happening to our subway systems and subterranean systems in general, once they've been exposed to salt water for extended periods of time. Never went in that direction, but someone should.
Yes, yes. And then come on the podcast and we'll interview about it. Yeah, that's great. I don't know. Laura, do you have any other questions for Lauren?
I think if I were to ask any question, it would just be, you know, how would somebody who's interested in doing the type of work that you do get started? Because, you know, sustainability is, we know what it is, but like you just pointed out, a lot of people don't. And I know that I, as a career coach, get a lot of people coming to me saying, I want to get into sustainability, but they don't even know what they're really asking for, you know? And if someone is an architecture track or is just looking to, like, do something with green buildings, like, for early on in their career, what do you suggest that they start doing?
I think that the best thing that they can do is I would recommend going and pursuing a credential a LEED accreditation, for example, or a WELL accreditation, a WELL building accreditation, living building, something like that. Mm-hmm. Go through the actual training to start to get that kind of crash course, for example, on, you know, what does it mean to be sustainable? Obviously, research, all of our technology evolves, all of the ways that we practice continues to evolve. And so research is obviously one of the best things. Just be a voracious reader. It doesn't have to be of books. It can be of things on, you know, websites, staying, you know, abreast of certain types of methods that people are utilizing. And then, like I said, those accreditations, and then just be a champion wherever it is that you're working. For example, if you want to be working at a firm, but maybe you're working for, you know, a furniture sales company, like make sure that you're the person that's kind of being the squeaky wheel about different things that you could be implementing, even just operationally, wherever you work. Be the person that champions for something to be better and kind of start to get your name out there in that respect. I mean, the reality is that we all have to pay our dues.
Yeah.
Right. So we're not ever really working like exactly where we think we're going to be working right when we're first starting in a career. And yeah. I think what ends up happening is that it's through the demonstration of your passion that gets you recognized and noticed and, you know, makes people feel like you're going to take things to the next level should they decide to kind of promote you into that role. So just be a champion for yourself and the environment.
Awesome. Great advice. And get yourself out there and network and meet people like Lauren who will also help you with that. Because Lauren was awesome at connecting me to people when I moved to Syracuse.
Happy to do it.
Well, it's been great having you on the show. I would like one more question to ask you. If you would like people to be able to find you or anything that you have coming up you want to talk about.
Sure. People can always find me on social media. My work life, we'll call it, is on Instagram at lauren.at.rehabitat. And I'm also on LinkedIn. You can just search me via Lauren Stanek. And I guess you can also find me on my website. So there's phone numbers and all types of connection points there at rehabitat-cny.com.
Awesome. Okay. Nick, you want to wrap us up?
That's perfect. Thank you, Lauren, for being on the show. I really appreciate having you on.
Yeah, this was awesome. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, well, that's our show for today. I want to thank you so much. I want to give a huge shout out and thanks to Lauren Stanek. It's Stanek, okay? I know it's Stanek. I'm so sorry that I threw that T in there. We had a whole conversation about how ridiculous it is that people can't say her name right. I'm sorry, Stanek. She was great. Really enjoyed having her on. So, and please be sure to check us out next week when we interview Dawn Wright, the chief scientist at Esri. It is a super cool, super cool interview. She was fantastic. So please do stay tuned next week for that. It's going to be great. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. Let us know how we're doing. But that's our show.
Thanks. Catch you next time.
See you, everybody.